From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. Do you trust technology with life and death?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
The Break Room Gang asks if we should count on robots to save the day. We'll also discuss the flesh and blood heroism of beachgoers in Florida. That's ahead this hour, but first, yesterday we discussed the party culture in Athens and UGA.
I think when people come here as a freshman, one of the first things they hear is this stat about how there are 80 bars or alcohol selling establishments within a 1 mile radius. And I think people think about an SEC school and football and game days. And I think that that image really kind of builds up in your mind, whether it tends to be true or not based on your own college experience. I think a lot of people come in with that expectation.
That's UGA senior Dylan Thompson. Here are your first thoughts. Nasty snowflake woman tweets. How will the binge drinking party culture affect or be affected by guns on campus? It seems like a dangerous combo. Well, that remains to be seen. Georgia's campus carry law has been in effect for just 2 weeks now, since July 1st. We always want to know what you think. Give us a call at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter. The show's at OST Talk. Or you can post to Facebook and we might feature your comments on the program. Tomatoes are a staple of Southern cooking. You can eat them green fried, simmered with onion and okra. Yum. As tangy additions on a sandwich. Yum. Or maybe best of all, as the sole essential ingredient of a sandwich. We, the tomato-loving people of Atlanta, even have a whole festival dedicated to them.
Attack of the killer tomatoes.
Okay, this weekend, Atlanta-based chef Ford Fry leads the 9th annual Attack of the Killer Tomato Festival. Ford is here. Ford, good morning.
Morning.
Also with us is the executive director of Georgia Organics, Alice Rolls. Alice, welcome.
Thank you.
Fry and rolls. Fried rolls. Let's get started. It's good to have you on the program. Look, Ford, let me start with you. Could you have imagined when you started this that you'd be 9 years into this thing?
I don't know. I think so. I mean, that was the goal. I mean, the goal was to get real big.
Yeah.
And I don't know that we've gotten real big yet, but it's real good right now. But it's pretty exciting.
So tell the story, the origin story of this festival. How did it start? How did you come up with the idea for it?
Okay, yeah. I mean, you know, I just started JCT, so I was about, and that was in 2000.
Tell everyone what JCT is.
JCT Kitchen is on the west side. It was my first restaurant. Mm-hmm. So what happened is, you know, we had all these, you know, farmers we just welcome into our back door. They just walked in, they brought what they had, and we bought it. And I would say about 2 years in, I remember the tomatoes in Georgia just being so amazing. And I'm like, we just got to buy all these tomatoes. And then it got to be a point in the summer where I know these farmers do not make money. I promise you, they work so hard. So I felt for these guys because they have like, they would come in the peak of the tomato season and say, listen, I've got pallets and pallets of tomatoes that I can't even get rid of. And I said, first thing I thought of was like, oh, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. And I thought, you know, how fun would that be is to have a festival solely dedicated to tomatoes, that the goal is to buy out all the tomatoes from the farmers because they couldn't give them away at the time.
Right.
So how could that help them? And then over time, it's kind of morphed into, wow, you know, just even a stronger appreciation for the farmer. And you know how some people have, you know, company parties and whatever.
That's
well,
right.
Farmer John over here doesn't get a company party. So this is his appreciation and her or whatever. This is all their, it's basically an appreciation party for them where we buy all their tomatoes so they're happy and then they get to come and hang out for free and everyone else can have fun. It's a casual festival. It's a fun festival, and everyone loves tomatoes, and Georgia produces the best tomatoes.
Ah, perfect segue. You ready to hear from some Georgians about their love of tomatoes?
Let's go.
Hi, my name is Fernando Barrera. I'm from Tucson, Arizona. I like my tomatoes fresh. I don't like them cooked or anything like that. I'd rather just eat them fresh off the vine.
Vitalia Davis, and I'm from Fayetteville, Georgia. I like them like cherry tomatoes whole, with a little bit of salt on them outside in my backyard. That's how I like them.
Scott Zepeda from Tampa, Florida. I like them best on my sandwiches.
And whether they're from Arizona or Georgia, everyone seems to love tomatoes. And look, Ford, how did you connect with Alice's organization?
Well, I knew Georgia Organics, and I knew their sole focus was just supporting the farmers and lifting them up. So it was just really the only fit, quite honestly, or probably the best fit. So I knew Alice, and I knew Georgia Organics, and had done some events with them. So I thought, hey, let's team up. And, you know, the other thing that I think that's carried Georgia Organics along is they have such a great following. And when it comes to a festival like this, it takes so many people to pull it off. And Georgia Organics just knocks it out of the park when it comes to the volunteers who come out and really, really work this festival.
Alice, to you, look, talk about your organization here. Pat yourself on the back a little bit here.
Well, I have to give credit to the chef community because they're really the ones who have reintroduced us to taste. And if you think about tomatoes, it's sort of the gateway drug for local and organic food because that's where you see the real taste difference. You go into a store, you know, any time of the year and you get the tomatoes that are bred for travel, not taste. So it brings us back to place. And the chefs are the ones who have really, I give hats off, they've led this movement. And I mean, we would be 10 years behind in the good food movement, I think, if the chef community really hadn't stepped in and helped introduce this idea of taste and connecting back to farmers and lifting those farmers. So our mission at Georgia Organics is to connect organic food from Georgia farms to Georgia families, and farmer prosperity is at the center of that because, as Ford said, these farmers bust their petunias.
Okay.
And they don't make a lot of money. And so what can we do to put dollars in their pockets and help them thrive so we can eat their good tomatoes?
Well, wait a minute. So what is the challenge? You kind of alluded to it being a challenge. What's been the challenge of your organization connecting the work of farmers, the good food produced on farms to Georgia?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you think about our food system over the past 30, 40 years, it's gotten big and global, and it's been depersonalized, quite frankly. So everything has gotten so big and scaled up that we've lost that human connection, and we've lost the crop planning and the meal planning in our local communities. So we're about shifting agriculture from a commodity mindset to really a community mindset. And this festival personifies that because you heard the stories that you just had. People, you know, just think about that juicy tomato, and,
right,
and there's place and there's a face to that. And that's what I love
about
this festival.
You want to hear more?
Sure, go
folks?
Ahead.
Yeah, let's play it.
Karen Hyges.
Barbara Barfield.
Lee Thorson.
I love tomatoes.
I love tomatoes. Certain things. I mean, I like tomatoes, but there's some versions of, like, tomato juice I don't like. Tomato soup I don't like.
I like tomatoes with ranch dressing.
I like a BLT, and I like the John Denver song, Homegrown Tomatoes.
good stuff. So, Ford, when folks come to the event, the festival, it's this Sunday. Let's set the schedule here. It's this Sunday starting, is it 1 p.m. in the afternoon?
Yeah, 1 to 5.
And where is it?
It's right on Piedmont Park.
The Park Tavern?
At Park Tavern.
Yeah. When folks come to the festival, give everyone listening to us right now a sense of that experience, what they're going to be in for.
Crazy, fun time, you know, other than, you know, what typically happens is people are lined up, ready to get in. And then right when the 1 o'clock hits, we just open the gates and they come in. And we've got, you know, typically part of it is some music component to it as well, which is really fun.
You're playing, right?
Yeah. We've always had some sort of a... No. Well,
no?
B-53s are the main, are the leading band. We're going to somewhat open up for the B-53s.
Ah.
And you know, so to kind of keep it in that Athens, Georgia vein, we're going to do a R.E.M. tribute.
Oh, terrific.
So we're called... We change our name every time, whoever, no matter what we're doing. So we are called... Remoulade. So Remoulade. So,
okay.
So you have that, but really what happens is everyone hits all the tables. They eat tomato tastings. They taste tomato cocktails because there's like 20 or plus mixologists. There's beer. There's wine. It's just crazy. But it's a crazy, casual, fun, great day.
Well, the best with it, and the best to Georgia Organics, and look forward. Have a great Sunday.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Atlanta-based chef Ford Fry and Alice Rolls, executive director of Georgia Organics. Thank you both, and have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Chuck Reese is the editor of the Bitter Southerner online magazine. He has an opinion on most everything, including the prescription for the perfect tomato sandwich.
There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning.
Instructions for making a tomato sandwich the right way should always begin with this couplet from the late great songwriter Guy Clark. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you a ripe one, don't get a hard one.
Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer, all winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging, every time I go out and pick me up this homegrown tomato.
Perfect tomato sandwiches require ripe, juicy tomatoes, preferably fresh off the vine or from your local farmer's market. If you don't have a tomato like that, then don't make a tomato sandwich. Few things are worse than a tomato sandwich with a mealy supermarket tomato. If you have a fine fresh tomato, and you should because it's summertime, you need only four other ingredients. Number one, white bread. By that, I do not mean dense homemade white bread. I mean store-bought white sandwich bread. Sunbeam is my go-to loaf. Number two, salt. Number three, black pepper. Freshly ground is best. And finally, number four, you need mayonnaise. The question of which mayo to use will always start an argument among tomato sandwich lovers. The battle is always between the two great southern mayonnaises, Duke's versus Blue Plate. Duke's origins were in Greenville, South Carolina. Blue Plate was born in Gretna, Louisiana. Hellman's, which originated in New York City, should not even be under consideration. Slice the tomato thickly, spread lots of mayo on the white bread, cover one side with tomato slices, then salt and pepper it to taste. The ideal tomato sandwich with a juicy ripe tomato and the requisite amount of mayonnaise will, when bitten into, send a stream of tomato juice and mayo down your arms. You can't wear long sleeves. It's also why you stand over the sink, so it can run down your arms and drip from your elbows safely into the drain. When you're finished eating, you can grab the soap, wash your arms and hands, then go on about your day, happy in the knowledge that you have made and eaten a tomato sandwich just as your grandmama intended.
That's editor-in-chief for the Bitter Southerner, Chuck Reese. And just ahead, heroism sparks a chain reaction. Our break room gang discusses a daring rescue on the Florida coast. This is On Second Thought.
Attack of the killer tomatoes. They'll beat you, bash you, squish you, mash you, chew you up for brunch, and finish you off for dinner or lunch.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headlee. It's been 20 years this month since the first Mars rover touched down on the Red Planet. The Sojourner wasn't much bigger than a toy, just a foot high and a couple of feet wide. But putting humans on the surface of Mars will take a much bigger set of wheels. One prototype for the job stops by Atlanta this weekend. Producer Emily Curitan brings us this audio postcard.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Shireman. I'm with Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. Experts estimate that the first person to step foot on Mars has already been born. We took the information that we have, that we know already about Mars, and we used that to create a vehicle that, one, yes, would look great and catch everyone's attention, but would also be realistic. It's designed to have a crew of four, actually. Four astronauts could sit in it. So it is a Mars rover concept vehicle, and we've taken it on a few test drives, and it doesn't go very fast, but you can understand why you wouldn't want to go very fast on Mars because of the terrain.
Hi, I'm Madison. I think it's really cool. I just want to go in it, and like, because I know that it's not the real one that went to space, but it would.
I'm Maddie. I don't think I would go to Mars. It's scary.
We are going to walk inside the Mars rover. They say it's only big enough for two people to go in. The back side is bigger than the front side, but you can walk up these steps and go check it out.
Hi, I'm David Sheritz. I'm from Tampa, Florida, and I'm right here visiting the Mars rover in Atlanta, Georgia. This over here is the cockpit area. Yeah, you can press stuff, turn stuff off. There's just all sorts of gadgets and gizmos and lights and all sorts of different colors. There's all sorts of lighting up buttons, just as you would see in some sort of sci-fi movie.
Actually, you could teach all this in a class someday.
You know, the good stuff, like how to make a bathtub using NASA tubing in an old RTG, how to cook a potato about 6,000 different ways.
I have seen Martian, and it's very realistic. They've used all the pretty much the current thinking and current technologies. My name is John McBride. I was in space just short of 9 days. I was scheduled to fly two more flights and didn't get to do those because of the tragedy of Challenger.
Yes, you may.
One of the things we've got to do before we even think about going to Mars is have the ability to recycle and reuse everything we take with us. We can't take enough food and water and expendables to last a crew of four for 3 years or so.
The Mars rover prototype is on display at SunTrust Park in Atlanta this weekend. You can see pictures and find more details about the Summer of Mars tour at our website, gpbnews.org. You know, we say this every week. It's been a long week. Do we ever get to the end of the week and say, wow, that really flew by? Not very often. We don't say that much. I'm engaging you guys. We don't say that very much, do we? Hello. Good morning.
Okay, morning. We didn't have enough coffee.
You're not morning. Enough. Okay, so it's been, let's start again. It's been a long week.
Yes, it has.
We spun some vinyl, played the cello, and partied maybe a bit too much in Athens and for some of you last night. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of really smart people to help us sort of kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Just do it! Yes, you can! Just do it!
Loving you is work, Jerry. Hard work. Like building a homeless shelter. Nobody wants to say no to doing it, but some people put the work in.
Help! Help us! We're drowning!
Okay, joining us in the break room are Nzanga Burton. She is a media and hip-hop scholar. Hector Fernandez is a professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State University. Natalie Pavelski is vice president of Cater Communications. And Greg Williams is with us. He's a mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. Welcome, everyone.
Morning.
Hello. Happy Friday.
Nzanga, break some news here. You're a professor. You're changing your life. Break this news on the program this morning.
So sadly, I am leaving the University of Georgia, yes. Grady College of Journalism and Mass Media, and headed to...
Happily,
chair the Department of Mass Media Arts at Clark Atlanta University, wow. The illustrious program over there.
Yeah, yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Changing your life. We
changing
love that.
Changing my life. Excited.
All right, you ready to dive in?
Yes. Sure.
Absolutely.
How much do you trust artificial intelligence?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that. I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Well, Alexa, now, where did that come from? Where that clip? Was that an alien clip? Was that,
no,
what was
no, 2001
Space Odyssey?
Oh, yes.
That's how.
That's old slap school.
Slap the host, slap the host, bad host. So, Alexa, the voice of Amazon's popular AI, called the cops. You guys have been following this story. Yeah. A man in New Mexico was allegedly beating his girlfriend. Alexa thought she heard a command and summoned the police, who arrived to help the woman and her son. Here's the question. Should those gadgets be programmed to recognize violence in a home, or is that a kind of a slippery slope toward a brave new world? And before we dive in, I should add, so that's the story we've been reading about, but Amazon and a National 911 Association, well, they're kind of throwing buckets and buckets of cold water on the story, saying it could not have unfolded the way it's described here by the sheriff of this county in New Mexico. Right. But the question is still a good one. Greg, let me start with you. You've got that system in your home.
My brother was nice enough to give me the CIA listening device, and we've installed it. I joke about it a lot. So I have Alexa, and my wife is from Ecuador, so now I have two Latinas that don't listen to a word I say.
Oh!
You have to
Latinas?
You have to. You're a Latino, my friend. But
we're off and running.
I was, when I first read this story, obviously the headline is pretty scary, but you actually, to control Alexa, and my wife, I love hearing her fight with Alexa after a couple of glasses of wine. So try to get Alexa to play music, and you have to say Alexa, and that will actually initiate the system, and it'll flash up a little bit. And then you have to give it a command. So unless this guy's wife or girlfriend or whoever it was, name was Alexa, then I find it really hard to believe that it somehow would have magically.
You have to program this right?
Well,
with contacts
Yes, although absolutely. On the 9/11 tape, they said 911 tape, they said that they heard her saying, "Alexa, call 911. Alexa, call 911."
Okay,
and that I think could actually be useful, but just sort of some general program to recognize violence, that I do not trust. Okay, I'll give you an example.
Okay,
the other day I dropped a dish in the kitchen. My 4-year-old comes running in, "Mommy, mommy!" I'm like, "Stay out, stay out!" And she's like, "Ah!" So if Alexa recognized that as glass breaking and people shouting and sent SWAT, we would have been in trouble.
Right, right. But there again, you've got to program. Is it certain words, keywords? Program 911 in the system so it does this connection to make that happen?
Well, most
I'm
people
are confused about it all.
So you can program it, and I have an Alexa, which I actually unplugged immediately after the second story.
Yes.
Yeah, because I have a 20-month-old. So, yeah, I was like, I do not want the police called on me when I and a puppy. Yeah, it's chaos in my house. It's chaos in my house. So, I think that, you know, when people buy Alexa, I wasn't looking for a listening device, right? So I think if you can make the command, yes, Alexa, call 911, then you should be able to do that. But I don't really want a device in my house listening for what I'm doing so that they can intervene in my life. I think it's a privacy issue. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Where do you come down on this, Hector?
Well, the machine is on most of the time. The microphone is on most of the time. That said, whether we like it or not, it's going to happen.
The listening device.
Yeah.
That's Greg's point. The listening device.
Yeah, it is a listening device at home. But it works a lot better than Siri. I said, I've tried both devices, and Alexa does work well.
Right.
Unlike Siri. But, I mean, at this point, I think it's too early for us to reach that point of device policing us, even though the microphone is on all the time.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and you just don't want it trying to interpret an activity or try to read our minds, for God's sake. I mean, it's like Skynet being self-aware from the Terminator movies. And it's, I was joking about unplugging it. We use Alexa for music. I've used it to order Uber before. But it is, I mean, you really, in order to trigger ours, so to speak, you have to say Alexa, and then it kind of pauses. So I don't. I think that's the voice activation. It does keep a transcript of every command you put in there, though. So,
okay.
And I was not joking. I did unplug it. I put it back in the box, and I'm going to throw it into the nearest trash can.
I'll buy from you.
Or into the nearest ocean.
Yes.
Being in the ocean. Wasn't that cute? Being in the ocean can be a matter of life or death.
Because there may come a time when difficult decisions must be made.
What difficult decisions? What are you talking about?
You know, like things you do to stay alive.
Are you talking about killing and eating me, Frank?
All I'm saying is that when you go into survival mode, it's every man for himself.
Last weekend in Florida. Now, this was really scary, right? A family of six trapped in a dangerous riptide or rip Current, or we can use, they're interchangeable.
Rip Current is the correct
term. That's what I'm thinking.
Yes.
Right, right, right. This was off Panama Beach. No lifeguards on duty. Beachgoers, and this is terrific, formed, it's like an 80-person human chain to actually reach the family. And it was this family and others who were trapped as well and saved them all. You know, so there are a lot of interesting elements to this story. But Natalie, for you, what's the most interesting?
The most surprising thing is that it worked.
That it worked, yeah.
A chain is only as strong as its weakest link, right? And for 80 people in Panama City on a Saturday evening to be sober and competent
and sober, strong,
and trusting enough to pull this off is remarkable.
I don't know if this is a sober idea, though. I mean, they're like, hey,
we're talking about a rip current,
let's
right?
Let's do this, guy. Finally, they remade an episode of Baywatch. It was actually worth watching.
Oh, my.
Or was this also buffet line for the sharks? But I was very impressed with this this humanism that was able to
humanism.
Think. Yep. Isn't it humanity to say, you know what, we're going to save these people.
We're going
to
figure it out.
We're going to figure out how to do it. We're going to be a connected chain and get probably, what, they were about 100 feet out at least. I mean,
well, it took an hour for them to pull everybody out.
I watched the photographic evidence of it, and it's just an amazing.
The thing is, some of the people have been in the water for up to 20 minutes.
Yes.
There was one woman who they believed was having a heart attack as this was happening, and she was essentially saying, just go save the others, let me go.
Yeah.
So this was high drama on the ocean.
Yeah, and I think what's great about this story to me is that people actually came together, because we really need some of that in our lives right now, came together and decided that they were going to do something to help someone. There's so much talk about, you know, people, take care of yourself. Oh, you went out there, now you're just caught up in the riptide. Deal with it, drown.
How about this? How about this?
I like that people
Someone
responded.
Posted this, to see people from different, this is to your point, Azenka, to see people from different races and genders come into action to help total strangers, in caps, total strangers, is absolutely amazing to see. People who didn't even know each other went hand in hand in a line into the water to try to reach them. Pause and just imagine that. Pretty good, right?
Yes.
Yep.
What are your thoughts on that, Hector?
Well,
cooperation, people working together in a time when all we seem to hear is about polarization, folks.
Well, we live in very selfish times, so I'm actually quite surprised that people cared enough to work together and do something, because we haven't had much of that lately. So from that perspective, it's quite impressive.
So help me with this one. There's new research showing that those who support public displays of Confederate memorials are the least likely to have basic knowledge of Civil War history. Now, put those two thoughts together, right?
Mm-hmm. That figures.
Yeah, researchers asked folks in Georgia and South Carolina two basic questions. First, who was General Sherman? Second, name two Civil War battles. Now, this group can handle that easily. Surprised by the finding here, that the conclusion here, that those who seem to know the least about the Civil War seem to be the most in favor and most supportive of the Confederate displays that are so controversial for so many around the country?
No, I'm not surprised. I think that the least amount that you know about the Confederacy, the more likely you are to support it. But if you actually get your facts together and you do your research and you look at it as a holistic experience for all involved, then it becomes more and more complicated to be a supporter. I'm a Richmond, Virginia native, capital of the Confederacy.
Wow, the Monument Row essentially there in Richmond.
Yes, Monument Avenue. So, you know, I grew up around this stuff, the Confederacy stuff, Daughters of the Confederacy, right up the street, walking distance. I walked past it from my home.
And the mayor there is sort of challenged right now to try to deal with that issue of what to do with the monuments, maybe a plaque to bring further context to the Civil War, something he's talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are have different ideas about it, but I think that you have to tell the truth and you do have to give context. But the celebration of these Confederate soldiers, generals, and what have you is highly problematic for a lot of people. And so, you know, it's going to take everyone to really decide how it should happen.
Greg, we're still litigating this thing, aren't we?
We've covered, it seems like every time I'm on the show, we talk about the Confederate flag or some kind of controversy. So I'm well informed on it. And what I will say about some of the people people that that defend the Confederate flag. Towards the end of the Civil War, we were not dealing with wealthy landholders or slave owners that were flying the flag. We were dealing with people that were fighting against invaders in their home. So a lot of the like the Battle of Chickamauga, that's one of them. Battle of Gettysburg. See, I already named my two right there. But
Battle of Shiloh.
Battle of Shiloh. Yeah, yeah. Those were, that was in Virginia.
So that was history.
So those battles were people defending their homes at that point in time. So I do see a little. I can defend people supporting that aspect of folks defending their home. I don't think the Confederate flag is 100% that you are a non-abolitionist and that you want slavery. So that's where I stand on it.
Yeah, but that to see it merely as a historical artifact ignores the fact that it became the banner for racists in the 50s and 60s.
It still is to a large extent, especially worldwide.
Yeah, the recent history, correct me if I'm wrong in saying it because you know more than I, but the recent history, that it is a signifier, not of, I had ancestors who fought and died.
Yeah, and the pushback is always that it's about heritage. It's not about hate.
No, I married into a family that had a couple of, you know, Confederate officers in it. And they would no more fly the Confederate flag than they'd blow up their own house.
All right, let's do this. Let's take a break. We've got, it gets hot here. It's Friday. We're in the break room just ahead. How did Shia LaBeouf end up in Savannah and in a jail? We know how he ended up in Savannah on a movie, but how did he end up in a Savannah jail? And who is to blame when a marriage goes awry? I'm going to sit that one out. That's next. It's on Second Thought. We just roll through the breaks. We've got so much to say. Yeah, don't hold back now. It's on Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room as we do each Friday. My guest today, Hector Fernandez, professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State. Natalie Pavelski is vice president for Cater Communications. Greg Williams, mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. And Nzanga Burton is a media and hip-hop scholar now at Clark Atlanta University. And we also want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating coffee for our guests this morning, as they do every week. They're online at savannahcoffee.com. Shia LaBeouf. Shia.
He should have gone to Savannah Coffee Roasters instead of wherever he went.
No, he was out tying one on.
With some Irish coffee, maybe.
When Shia wants to do something, boy, he really does it.
Just do it! Don't let your dreams be dreams. Yesterday, you said tomorrow. So just do it! Make your dreams come true! Just do it!
Yeah, and this time he might have done it wrong, right? Last week, Shia LaBeouf was arrested in Georgia for public drunkenness. He tried to escape arrest by fleeing into his hotel, because that always works, right? Should celebrities, here's the question, should celebrities get a little leeway, Nzanga, on these things when, you know, everything that happens to them, it's not the same way for us, but everything that happens to them seems to make headlines, or am I making an excuse for it?
That would be a no.
That would be a no.
No. I think that celebrities are people, and, you know, they'd like to remind us when they are just humans like the rest of us.
Yeah.
And so I think if you get arrested for public drunkenness, then you should be arrested for public drunkenness.
Yeah, but this got ugly fast, didn't it?
He has Mel Gibson syndrome. So.
Yeah, this is not the first time he's been in trouble.
Natalie, it really got ugly fast. Yeah. I mean, he was talking about a black officer who was going to go to hell because of his skin color. Okay, you ready for the next level of this? He taunted a white officer about his wife's sexual preferences, essentially saying that she preferred sex with black men. I mean, it.
Oh, good Lord. Look, this is a problem for him. This is not his first arrest. He can afford a driver, a babysitter, a bodyguard, somebody to keep him out of trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't accept the money and the fun of being a celebrity and then complain about the spotlight that comes with it.
Right. Greg, what's going on with this young man? I mean, I've heard commentary suggesting that he has maybe even mental issues. Mm-hmm. You know, or is this a moment where the alcohol is really his truth serum?
When you've been growing up and your name is a stage name at a drag concert, you're going to have some issues kind of over the years. And now Shia LaBeouf. I mean, yes. Right.
That was brutal.
I think that he's had some issues for a very, very long time. And he's probably upset that Mark Wahlberg got cast in the Transformers and not him. So it's been a rough time. And what, wasn't the movie...
You mean there's an actor who actually wants to star in the Transformers?
Wasn't the movie that he's starring in called like the Peanut Butter Kid?
Something like that, right.
Let's talk about that a little bit. My God, that storyline was hilarious. Y'all need to Google Peanut Butter Kid or something. I mean,
have you done that? Have you Googled it?
I have not, but I was listening to 96 Rock or somebody talking about the theme of the movie.
Well, tell us. Inform us.
I don't remember.
It is the break room.
It was pretty... It was a very horrible theme, but I think it was a kid that wanted to be a boxer or something like that. I can't remember exactly. That's y'all's job to Google.
The kid has an addiction problem. So I mean, at the very least, we should feel for him.
Yeah. I mean, that seems pretty clear. Yeah. But here's the thing: the reason that we root for him to the extent that we root for him at all is because he's still young. I guess he's 31 years old. Mm-hmm. He's super talented, right? Mm-hmm. And he seems to be a kid. Hector, to your point, who seems to be suffering from some kind of... He wrote a statement. And he
apologized. And actually, it was a very well-phrased apology. So like, I give him some credit. Like Natalie said, it's not the first time. It's obvious he has an addiction problem. Yeah. He has the resources to do something about it. I mean, in Hollywood, we've already seen that before. You know, an actor... come back, right?
Right. Oh, so, yeah. Many times.
Robert Downey Jr. comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. Bright Light, big city star, among other things. Now Iron Man and everything else. So the actor wrote in a statement posted on Twitter Wednesday. Shia says that he has been publicly struggling with addiction for far too long. He called his behavior a new low and attributed to, in part, his complete disrespect for authority.
Now, this was a really good apology, as Hector suggested. Yeah. It was not a non-apology apology. He said, we hear a ton of those, right? Oh, don't we, though?
Yeah.
Daily.
So let me transition to this one. This was more of a hot topic last week, and I thought it would get a lot more attention than it did. But in Trump world, I mean, it's just a news cycle for a couple of minutes, and then we're on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Walter Schaub, right, head of the Government Ethics Office, resigned last week, saying it appears Trump businesses are making money off of his presidency. He thinks the ethics program needs to be stronger. So if it turns out, Hector, that nothing illegal is occurring, does it matter if the president profits from his or her tenure?
Absolutely. It sets a very bad precedent. I mean, in the past, we had presidents profiting after they left office. But while you're in office, you should not be doing that. I personally think this administration doesn't care about anybody else but themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's doing it left and right. It's doing it left and right. And in the world of fake news that we're living, nobody cares anymore because you can't tell between, you know, the truth and lies, which are everywhere.
So here's something that Walter said. He was asked during a CBS News interview whether Trump's businesses were benefiting from his time in office. And he said, can't be sure. I can't know what their intention is. I know that the effect is that there is an appearance that the businesses are profiting from his occupying the presidency, and appearance matters as much as reality.
Which is why every modern president has, with any kind of complicated financial portfolio, has put his assets in an honest-to-God blind trust. Reagan did it, both Bushes, Clinton. And there's a reason for that.
Remind, what has the president done? What has he set up? He set up some structure. I remember the news conference where there were reams.
Of blank pages.
Reams of blank
pages. They wouldn't let us look at them.
Right. And transferring that power to your sons, who we now know are, you know, and your children that are intricately involved in the administration, you know, it's just problematic. It would be one thing if they weren't involved, but every time you turn on the television, you see Ivanka, you see one of the sons or what have you.
Mm-hmm. And the Secret Service paying to a company.
It's just,
right.
It's just too vague, though, this accusation. They might be profiting from his being the president. Is he garnering contracts somehow, or is attendance at his hotel sales up because he's become more of a celebrity. Because now, I mean, he already had a pretty high name ID, folks.
Right, but this is the thing. The American people shouldn't have to worry about whether foreign policy is being made on the basis of where the next cheesy Trump hotel is going.
And you know, again, this was a very vague accusation about they might be profiting because he's president.
But they have been profiting. If you look at the amount of money the State Department and the
Vegas is going to disappear and it's going to become really concrete.
I'm going to be happy, and when that happens, when it becomes non-ambiguous, then I will certainly be logical about it.
The appearance of impropriety, though. You understand that, Greg. You may not be doing anything, but if it looks like it, it still has consequences.
But how does it look like it? Just because his businesses are doing a little bit better because he's now president, if he's not actively engaged in doing that, if he's not tweeting about everybody stay at Trump Plaza next to Chicago, he's not tweeting that.
Look, there's a reason.
I don't think he's abusing that level right now.
I don't see why he's such a special snowflake uber capitalist case that he doesn't need to follow the same rules that all the other presidents have followed. Now, this is the reason.
I do wonder to what extent the public, you know, has baked this in. It's been baked in.
Yeah, because if you look at it, I'll give you some specific numbers, just a few things, okay? During the campaign, as an example, the Secret Service spent $2.75 million to accompany Trump on campaign trips. Now, this is something all candidates get beyond a certain point. However, he was flying his own private jet. So the Secret Service, i.e. taxpayer money, $2.75 million of taxpayer money went to the Trump Organization to pay for the president's Secret Service coverage.
And Greg, I'm going to give you the last word on this before we move on.
Thanks. Do
you just want to move on?
Well,
and Greg?
Well, we're happy to just move on.
And we're moving on.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing
Let's
to see
just
here.
Just move along.
Okay, a new UK study finds when there is infidelity in a marriage. This is a UK study. Women are more likely to blame the other woman while men blame their unfaithful spouse. Mm-hmm. Why this difference? Who wants to weigh in first? Who's chomping at that? Hector, hand up first.
Wow. I'll say this sounds about right because men are really petty about a bunch of things. We can be really petty about a number of things. And emotionally, compared to the ladies, I think we're lacking. So to that respect, there would be a certain tendency for us to place blame within a closer circle. I mean, at least that's my perspective on my own gender.
Yeah.
Well, there's a saying that the first time Adam had the chance, he laid the blame on women. And humankind has been following suit ever since.
That sounds really biblical.
So that would be the genesis of this whole thing, I suppose, right?
Ooh, well done, biblical quote.
Hey, no problem. I'm a right winger. I should know the Bible, right? But you know, I was thinking that I think we can modernize this a little bit. Let's go ahead and admit the way a transaction would occur, right? A man is always going to be. Would you like to have sex? Yes, I would. So to me, the final arbiter
women
or the decision maker,
really?
The woman is the one who is making the decision. A man pretty much is always going to be like, yes, 99% of the guys I know, they don't care if it's the first date, the last date, whatever. The woman is kind of the decision maker in this process. So
Boo.
I can see, you don't agree?
Greg,
this is empowering women here.
Negative.
Absolutely.
No. No. That's an emphatic no, Greg.
Okay.
Women are socialized to distrust other women by women. By women. That is how we are socialized by and large. And even, and what we hear from generations down, right? If you have infidelity in your family, it's never that, you know, dad stepped out. It's that other woman broke up my family, right?
Oh.
You know, and we are socialized to hate. Like, we are socialized to hate on each other, right? So-and-so has blonde hair. I want blonde hair.
But don't
so-and-so
you.
Has red hair. I want red hair. So-and-so, I'm not going to say, oh, I love your blonde hair. You're like, oh, my God, that chick has blonde hair.
I think I'm far more empowering message for women
but
than
don't
yours.
But don't you love that Greg was willing to go there?
Greg,
if you were just your
good try, Greg, but no.
We are hanging out in the break room with Natalie Greg. Pavelski, Vice President of Cater Communications, Greg Williams. Greg, mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio show Greg's List, Nzenga Burton, who's a media and hip-hop scholar now over at Clark Atlanta University, and Hector Fernandez, professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State. Let me see if I can sneak another one in here. Marvel Comics creator Stan Lee lost his wife Joan last week. Now, when Stan wanted to quit making comic books, She convinced him to write The Fantastic Four. How about that? It changed the course of his life. Hector, has anyone in your life given you really good, really solid, let's call it life-changing advice? And then we'll go around the room.
Sure, my literature professor from college, because I'm an electrical engineer, but I went to grad school for Hispanic languages and literature. So I followed a different road. I mean, and it's the best decision I ever made, you know. My life is rich because of that, and I live my dream.
Why the suggestion, you think? Why was that advice offered to you?
Because basically social pressure, society tries to set your goals, whereas you have to try to find your heart and try to find out what is it that is really going to make you happy in life. And if you're happy with that, you know, things are going to work in the end, and everything will come together.
Yeah. Nzenga.
Yeah, so my mother told me that life is a process. And I remember prior to that, I was completely impatient. I wanted what I want when I wanted it.
I recognize that.
Yeah. I mean, I really thought that if I wanted it, I could make it happen. And just that one thing, like, listen, relax. Life is a process. It made me more thoughtful. It made me more intentional. And so, and I have great patience now because mm-hmm. that really, for whatever reason, it just stuck with me. Mm-hmm. So now as I go through life, whether it's personally, professionally, spiritually, or what have you, I exercise that process, that patience, and think to myself, life is a process.
Do you feel the moments when the impatience is rising up in you?
Yes, and then I chant to myself quietly.
You chant?
Yes.
That was my next question. What do you do about it?
Yes, I chant. I meditate.
Yeah.
And then I realized I'm committed to happiness. So someone else told me that too, a professor. But I have made a commitment to being happy. And so I know what that looks like for me. And so part of being happy is not being stressed out and pressed about things that you really can't control and outcomes you can't control.
Right.
And so, you know, I just go ahead and let the process happen.
Nice.
Yeah. I guess, you know, for me, it's never been necessarily one person that's given me advice. I've always been a bit of a risk taker in some of the business avenues, but having...
Well, did someone encourage you to do that?
Well, absolutely, and that's what I was about to say. My parents are listening from Marietta right now. Hi, Mom mm-hmm. and Dad. But they have provided such a strong, powerful social construct for me that they have basically, you know, been willing to help out if a business went bad. And being in the mortgage business for 15 years, I can assure you, mm-hmm. there was some down times for Greg Williams, and I was blessed to have a family that was very supportive of whatever I did, and very patient with my career path.
Yeah. I'll dive in just to say that there was a moment when I was just starting in this business, and I got a great piece of advice from a reporter in Cleveland who said, you know, you just got to be yourself. Whether it works here, it may not work here, but ultimately you got to be yourself and you'll find the place where it works. Natalie, how about you?
Well, my the America's first female Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, was my faculty advisor at Georgetown. And she used to tell all of her women students about when she started in government in the National Security Council staff, the men would jump in and mix it up, and the women would sit there and timidly raise their hand and hope to be recognized, which limited their input, of course. She said, look, first make sure you know what you're talking about, and then speak up and interrupt. And I've been doing it ever since. Sorry, Greg.
That's terrific. And it's helped you in your career path and at various points and stages in your life?
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, the biggest chunk of my career was as a journalist a television journalist, which is not exactly the least sexist environment.
We were kind of colleagues the big house for a while.
CNN, And as you may know, that's not exactly the least sexist environment to be on camera in, right?
Yes,
we don't care if it's a fabulous story. Your hair is a mess, right?
Right.
So you have to be strong and you have to be willing to speak up.
Oh, terrific. Thank you. What a great break room. I'm loving this. Thank you all. We are all out of time in the break room today. And thanks to my guest, Greg Williams. He's a mortgage banker and host of the conservative radio show, Greg's List. Greg, thanks.
Thank you.
And Nzenga Burton is a media and hip hop scholar. Her new address is over at Clark Atlanta University. Nzenga, good to see you again.
Thank you, Tony.
Hector Fernandez is professor of world languages and cultures at Georgia State. Hector, a pleasure.
Pleasure, same thing. Have a great weekend.
Yeah, you too. And Natalie Pavelski is vice president for Cater Communications. Natalie, a pleasure. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Tony.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, each and every one of you. And that's all of our time for the show today. We want to hear from you. You can reach us at Facebook and OST Talk on Twitter. Have a great weekend, everyone. This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris, in for Celeste Headlee.